So we're in the book of Exodus, and with the book of Exodus, we have the continuation of the story that we left off with in the book of Genesis. In the book of Genesis, it was the beginning of creation, the beginning of sin coming into the world. There was the flood of Noah's day, and then the dispersion of the races at the Tower of Babel. And then the book focused the majority of itself on Abraham and his descendants, because God chose a man that he would bring into this land called the Promised Land, and he would reveal himself to, and he would reveal himself through him and his descendants, ultimately bringing the Savior, the Lord Jesus Christ, into the world through Abraham's descendants. So we looked at Abraham and his son Isaac and his son Jacob. And then Jacob had 12 sons, and they would be the heads of the 12 tribes of Israel. And so we're following that history through the Old Testament. And Joseph was the link. We spent a few weeks on Joseph. He was the link that brought Jacob and his sons and their families down into Egypt because of a great famine that was in the land at that time. And so that's how they got into Egypt. Jacob died. They took him back to the land of Canaan. As we close the book of Genesis, Joseph died, and he's embalmed, and he's in a casket in Egypt with a promise that he received from his brethren that he would not be left there when they came back to when God brought them into the Promised Land. So a few hundred years have passed since Joseph, and there arose a Pharaoh, a king, that was intimidated by the size of Israel. Israel came down as a relatively small group, and they grew into a great nation, just like God said they would. And so because of his concern that the children of Israel would fight against them in time of war, he made them slave laborers. And so they were in hard bondage for many, many years. And so they cried out to God, and God sent them a deliverer named Moses. And so Moses is the key figure here in the book of Exodus. And what Moses will do is he will bring them out of the land of Egypt through the Red Sea and to the Sinai Peninsula, to Mount Sinai, where he will receive the law from God. And this is what we refer to as the Old Covenant, where Moses received this covenant from God. And basically it was, if you keep God's law, you'll be blessed. If you disobey God's law, you'll be cursed. And so it's a works-based covenant that he received from him there, as well as part of that is the Ten Commandments. And he also received the instructions on how to build the tabernacle, which was this portable tent that they would carry in the wilderness to approach God and worship him there. And so that's the gist of what we have here in the book of Exodus, as God brings forth a deliverer. The title of the book itself is actually taken from a Greek word. It's what they call transliterated from the Greek into English. And so Exodus, the meaning of the word is departure or the way out. And it's based on the main theme of the book, Israel being led out of Egypt or departing Egypt in that bondage that they had at that time. It's taken from the Greek translation of the Hebrew scriptures, the Old Testament, written in Hebrew, a little bit of Aramaic, but there was a Greek translation about the second century BC called the Septuagint, and they titled the book Exodus, again, for the theme of it, meaning departure. In the New Testament, and of course, the New Testament was written in Greek, we have this Greek word Exodus used three times, but it's translated there as, in one place, departure, where it's used of Israel coming out of Egypt. That place would be Hebrews 11:22, where it says, by faith, Joseph, when he was dying, made mention of the departure of the children of Israel and gave instructions concerning his bones. So the word departure is the Greek word Exodus. And so it again means to depart or to be brought out of this. It's only used two other times in the New Testament. And when it's used so sparingly, it draws attention to me. And so you start searching where they're used. The other time, one of the other times it's used is when Jesus is on the Mount of Transfiguration. And it's there that he's talking with Moses, who is the one who brought Israel out of Egypt, and also Elijah. And it says in Luke 9:30 and 31, and behold, two men talked with him who were Moses and Elijah, who appeared in glory and spoke of his decease, which he was about to accomplish at Jerusalem. Now, what they were talking with him about was his upcoming death, his crucifixion upon the cross, his crucifixion that would free us from our sins. And it's the Greek word exodus that's being used here. And what I find interesting in tying this together is that it was at the Passover, where the Passover feast, they're celebrating this great exodus of God bringing the forefathers of Israel out of Egypt. It's at the Passover that Jesus institutes an even greater deliverance, and that would be the deliverance from sin and the resulting death. That would be his death upon the cross. And so isn't it neat how those two are tied together right there, the great deliverances that God has done for his people. The one other place that it's used is by Peter in 2 Peter chapter 1, and it's when Peter is giving his final words, and he says, "Moreover, I will be careful to ensure that you always have a reminder of these things after my decease, after my exodus, after my departure." And what he's referring to is his death, but what happens at death for the believer? What happens at death is you shed this corruptible body, don't you? You shed this mortal body, and you're delivered from this bondage, if you will, of corruption to incorruption, to finally be with the Lord. So it's kind of neat, isn't it, as you trace that thought through there. Again, exodus meaning departure, and it's the main theme that we have in this book, is God will send Moses to deliver his people. So let's tie it together here as we start with chapter 1. Verse 1, and we read, "Now these are the names of the children of Israel who came to Egypt. Each man and his household came with Jacob. Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, and Benjamin, Dan, Naphtali, Gad, and Asher. All those who were descendants of Jacob were 70 persons, for Joseph was in Egypt already. So these are the sons of Jacob. And as we've looked at before, Jacob had these children by his two wives, Leah and Rachel, and their handmaids, Zilpah and Bilhah. So from this one man came these 12 sons who would be the heads of the 12 tribes of Israel. It's the record here that we see of his family that came down into Egypt. And, you know, I mentioned the title that we have in our Bibles, Exodus, taken from the Greek Septuagint. In the Hebrew Bible, the title of the book is called, "Now These Are the Names." Those first few words of verse 1 is how it's titled, or names. And so it's following the first words, which are speaking of Jacob and his family. Again, the Greek takes the main theme of the book, the departure of Israel out of Egypt. So they come down 70 into the land, and verse 6 says, "And Joseph died, all his brothers and all that generation. But the children of Israel were fruitful and increased abundantly, multiplied and grew exceedingly mighty, and the land was filled with them." Now, we're going to see that these 70 turned into about 2 to 3 million in a few hundred years, because when they come out of Egypt, the fighting men are numbered, and they're numbered at over 600,000 people. So when you add the elderly into that, when you add probably wives and children into that, they estimate 2 to 3 million people. So you have this huge company that has come about within Egypt. And this is what's going to make Pharaoh the king nervous, because they are so mighty in the land. Verse 8 says, "Now there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph. And he said to his people, 'Look, the people of the children of Israel are more and mightier than we. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply and it happen in the event of war that they also join our enemies and fight against us, and so go up out of the land.'" So again, a lot of time has passed. A king arose that didn't know Joseph or didn't regard Joseph. The Pharaoh of Joseph's day was extremely favorable to him, had, of course, used him in a powerful way during the famine at that time, had given his family the best pasture land at that time, the land of Goshen. But now there arises a king that is not favorable towards him. And because, again, of the multiplication of Israel, he's concerned that if they're attacked, that Israel, if they side with the enemies of Egypt, then they could easily be overrun. And so they bring them under hard bondage. It says in verse 11, "Therefore they set taskmasters over them to afflict them with their burdens. And they built for Pharaoh supply cities, Pithom and Ramses. But the more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied and grew. And they were in dread of the children of Israel. So the Egyptians made the children of Israel serve with rigor. And they made their lives bitter with hard bondage, in mortar, in brick, and in all manner of service in the field. All their service in which they made them serve was with rigor. The idea is being really harsh on them. So they made them slave labor. They were the ones that were doing the building projects of Pharaoh and the Egyptians at the time. In fact, there is a tomb painting that dates to the 18th dynasty of Egypt, which they believe is the same time frame as this, that depicts the making of bricks and the building projects and so forth that were happening at this time. And so they made them serve with rigor or harshness, but the more they were afflicted, the more they multiplied. You know, I think there's a spiritual truth in that as well. You know, when we go through really difficult times, the hotter the heat is, the more we can grow in our relationship with the Lord. It's true, isn't it? In verse 15, it says, "Then the king of Egypt, as they continued to multiply, spoke to the Hebrew midwives, of whom the name of one was Shipra and the name of the other Puah. And he said, 'When you do the duties of a midwife for the Hebrew women and see them on the birth stools, if it is a son, then you shall kill him. But if it is a daughter, then she shall live.'" Now, the midwives would perform the work of what our modern day doctors would in assisting with the deliveries. The birth stool, from my understanding, is like two stones that the women would lean against for leverage and let gravity help with the giving of birth at that time. And so the instruction was to the midwives that are assisting, if it's a boy, then go ahead and kill him so we can, again, take care of the race here. Verse 17 says, "But the midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but saved the male children alive. So the king of Egypt called for the midwives and said to them, 'Why have you done this thing and saved the male children alive?' And the midwives said to Pharaoh, 'Because the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women, for they are lively and give birth before the midwives come to them.' Therefore, God dealt well with the midwives, and the people multiplied and grew very mighty. And so it was because the midwives feared God that he provided households for them." It's neat to see how God's hand of blessing is upon the midwives for doing, in this case, the right thing, weren't they? In sparing the firstborn that were coming out or the males that were coming out. In regard to obeying the laws of the land, that is what we are to do as believers. The exception comes when it breaks the higher laws of God. We have to then make sure that we're following God's laws. When Peter and John were before the religious leadership in their day in the book of Acts chapter 4, it says that they called them and commanded them not to speak at all nor teach in the name of Jesus. But Peter and John answered and said to them, "Whether it is right in the sight of God to listen to you more than to God, you judge. For we cannot but speak the things which we have seen and heard." God's higher law of teaching people about Jesus had to trump what the religious leadership was saying. And as Peter would conclude in Acts 5:29, we ought to obey God rather than men. And that's what we're called to do as well. And we obey the laws of our land. We're to be good citizens. But if those laws break the laws of God, then we need to stand right before the Lord. And I think that's what these midwives are doing. And I think that's why God blessed them because of that, because they were following his laws. It says in verse 22, "So Pharaoh commanded all his people, saying, 'Every son who is born, you shall cast into the river, and every daughter you shall save alive.'" And so now it's not just the Hebrew midwives, but as everybody has the directive here, if you see, and I think the inference is if it's a Hebrew male that's being born, take him and throw him into the river, because this king feared what was going to take place if this group multiplied on the land. It kind of reminds me of Herod in the days of Jesus, where there was born he who is king of the Jews, and he was afraid. And so he sent, remember, to have all the little babies in Bethlehem killed, but Jesus escaped because of his mother Mary and Joseph. And where did they go? Do you remember where they fled to? They fled to Egypt. Isn't that interesting? Where they were preserved until the death of Herod. And so Moses is going to be spared as he comes on the scene. And we have deliverers that are rising up, even though there are these kings that want to put them to death. And so we look on in chapter 2. It says, and a man of the house of Levi went and took as wife a daughter of Levi. So the woman conceived and bore a son. And when she saw that he was a beautiful child, she hid him 3 months. But when she could no longer hide him, she took an ark of bulrushes for him, daubed it with asphalt and pitch, put the child in it, and laid it in the reeds by the river's bank. And his sister stood afar off to know what would be done to him. Now, of course, this is Moses. And later on in the book of Exodus, we're going to learn the names of his mother and father. It would be Jochebed, his mother, and Amram, his father. He would have an older brother named Aaron, who's 3 years older. And of course, his older sister, who is named Miriam. And his parents were willing to put their own lives in jeopardy by saying, we're not going to put our child to death. And in Hebrews chapter 11, verse 23, it says, by faith, Moses, when he was born, was hidden 3 months by his parents because they saw he was a beautiful child and they were not afraid of the king's command. And so they hid him as long as they could. But when he hit 3 months, they couldn't hide him any longer. And so at that time, they made an ark, as it says here, to save him. It's interesting, the only other place in the Old Testament where you find this word ark, and it's used a number of times, but the only other place that it's used in chapters 6 through 8 where it speaks of Noah's ark, that God had Noah built to do what? To save him and his family. And so here you have this ark, this basket that's built, and Moses is placed in it, is put in the reeds by the river's bank. And so they were kind of doing what Pharaoh said to do, right? Take the male child, throw him into the river, only had a little bit of protection here as he's put in there. And as you read this story, I think it's more than, of course, it's more than just chance. But what I'm meaning is maybe they had a plan. Maybe they knew that Pharaoh's daughter would frequent this area of the river, and perhaps they put the baby there that he might be spared by Pharaoh's daughter, because that's what we see as it begins to unfold. In verse 5, it says, then the daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe at the river, and her maidens walked along the riverside, and when she saw the ark among the reeds, she sent her maid to get it. And when she opened it, she saw the child, and behold, the baby wept. So she had compassion on him and said, this is one of the Hebrews' children. Then his sister said to Pharaoh's daughter, shall I go and call a nurse for you from the Hebrew women that she may nurse the child for you? And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, go. So the maiden went and called the child's mother. Then Pharaoh's daughter said to her, take this child away and nurse him for me, and I will give you your wages. So the woman took the child and nursed him. And the child grew, and she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. So she called his name Moses, saying, because I drew him out of the water. This is a pretty good deal, isn't it? Not only does her son get to live, but she gets to get paid for being a mom, for nursing him. And so she has Moses for how long, we're not told, but I would imagine until he was weaned. And so in that culture, you know, we can only guess on how long that was. But it was an important time because undoubtedly she is speaking to her little baby boy all of the truths of who his God is and who his people are, and instilling in him at that young, impressionable age the things that would change his heart as the years went by. And one of the things that I find to be so true, and we found to be true as we were raising our kids, and we heard a number of times, is that those first 5 years are the most important years that you have with your children. And for the young ones, especially that are here, who undoubtedly are going to grow up and you're going to have children, sometimes we seem to think that, well, when they reach teenagers, that's when we really need to invest in them. You know, I think it was Josh McDowell, one of the ones that said, you know, give me a child until he's 5 years old and that's all I need. And the idea is in those 5 years, you're creating a bond with those kids. They're pushing the envelope, aren't they? During those terrible twos, as some people refer to them. And you're the one who's establishing that relationship with them, helping them establish those boundaries, and also instilling within them those things that are so foundational for the rest of their lives. And so as you're building that relationship with your child, that is really what's going to bring forth the fruit in the later years. The problem that all of us face, though, is that we're human. And let me rephrase that. The problem all of us face is that we're sinful and we're selfish and we have young children. And it's like, well, what about me? What about my me time and everything? And we fail so often to invest that quality time with our kids. But that is the key age where you want to invest that time with your children, because as they grow up, that relationship is just going to build and it's going to blossom. And I want to say this too, it's never too late to establish that relationship, to work on it. But if, especially for the young ones who haven't had the kids yet, when they come, make it a priority, because you will be blessed in the end when you do that. And so these early years that Jochebed had with Moses, where she could pour into him, and then that time came where she had to come and give him up and give him over to Pharaoh's daughter. And it was at that time that Moses became her son. And so he's gone from having that precious time with his real mother to now being raised in all of the wealth and power of Egypt. It says in Acts chapter 7, verse 22, Moses was learned in all the wisdom of the Egyptians and was mighty in words and deeds. When you think about it, it was the richest place you could possibly be, would have the most opportunities for a person to grow up. But we'll see that Moses will repudiate that Egyptian heritage for the sake of his Hebrew brethren, because he was Hebrew at heart. You know, through and through, that's what had been instilled in him. And this would be the man that God would use. And so Moses is born. Moses is now given over to Pharaoh's daughter. And we read in verse 11, now it came to pass in those days when Moses was grown that he went out to his brethren and looked at their burdens. Now, I just want to stop for a moment, because again, in the book of Acts, Stephen is giving us a running narrative on the history of Israel. And in the book of Acts, we find out that Moses is 40 years old at this point. And so he gives us the time. Here in this passage, it just says it came to pass in those days. But in Acts 7, we find that Moses is 40 at this point. And he looked out at his brethren. He saw their burdens. And it says at the end of verse 11, and he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his brethren. So he looked this way and that way. And when he saw no one, he killed the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. And when he went out the second day, behold, two Hebrew men were fighting. And he said to the one who did the wrong, why are you striking your companion? Then he said, who made you a prince and a judge over us? Do you intend to kill me as you killed the Egyptian? So Moses feared and said, surely this thing is known. And when Pharaoh heard of this matter, he sought to kill Moses. But Moses fled from the face of Pharaoh and dwelt in the land of Midian, and he sat down by a well. So he's raised in all of the luxuries and royalties of the king's palace, but we find that he is still a Hebrew and he still cares for his brethren here who are being mistreated, who are slaves under heavy taskmasters. Again, it tells us in Hebrews chapter 11, by faith Moses, when he became of age, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin, esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures in Egypt, for he looked to the reward. He gave it all up, didn't he? He gave it all up because he cared for his brethren. And that is such a truth. Egypt, as we look at spiritually, is a type of the world. And so it's a good picture of forsaking the things of the world for the things of God and recognizing the value of the two. And, you know, the passing pleasures of sin, sin wouldn't be tempting, would it, if there was no pleasure in it? But there is pleasure in sin, and that's what brings the temptation to all of us. Moses is such a great example here of forsaking that which would have been pleasant in his day, but would not have yielded the long reward. And the same thing would be true for us as well, that we forsake the temporal pleasures of this life, the stuff that would lead us into sin, for being the people that God has called us to be. And notice Hebrews 11:24, he did it by faith, okay? It was an act of faith, an act of trusting that God's way was better than the ways of Egypt. And so he runs, flees from Pharaoh for his life, and he goes to the land of Midian. Now, Midian is somewhere out there in this Sinai Peninsula, somewhere in that area. It will be roughly in that area that he will lead Israel to Mount Sinai, where he will receive the law of God and the Ten Commandments. And so he flees out here at the age of 40. And it says in verse 16, now the priest of Midian had seven daughters, and they came and drew water, and they filled the troughs to water their father's flock. Then the shepherds came and drove them away, but Moses stood up and helped them and watered their flock. When they came to Reuel, their father, he said, how is it that you have come so soon today? And they said, an Egyptian delivered us from the hand of the shepherds. And he also drew enough water for us and watered the flock. So he said to his daughters, and where is he? Why is it that you have left the man? Call him that he may eat bread. Then Moses was content to live with the man, and he gave Zipporah, his daughter, to Moses. And she bore him a son. He called his name Gershom, for he said, I have been a stranger in a foreign land. And so he's in Midian. He is with the priest of Midian, who is named Reuel. Later we'll see that Reuel's name is also Jethro. Now, the Midianites, this is kind of neat, they were actually descendants of Abraham. So Midian was a son of Abraham, not through Sarah, that was Isaac that came through Sarah, not Ishmael, that was Hagar, but it was Keturah. It was the wife that Abraham got after Sarah died. So it's speculation, but you would think the truths of who the true and living God is would have been passed down from Abraham to his son Midian. And here you have a priest of Midian whose name is Reuel, which means friend of God. So there's a good chance that this man is a priest of the true and the living God, that Moses comes and spends, and as again, Stephen tells us, he will spend some 40 years out there with him. So he's gone from 40 years in Egypt to now 40 years in being in the desert. He's going to be, at this point, 80 years old. He has a wife. He has a son at this point. And it says in verse 23, now it happened in the process of time that the king of Egypt died. Then the children of Israel groaned because of the bondage, and they cried out. And their cry came up to God because of the bondage. Notice God's response in verse 24. So God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. And God looked upon the children of Israel, and God acknowledged them. These four things just jump out here. Israel is under hard bondage, and the taskmasters are causing them to just be beaten and build these cities. And so they're crying out to God, and it says that God hears them. God heard the prayers of his people, and God remembered. And it's not that God forgot. God, it's a human way of saying God is faithful to the promises and the covenants that he has made, that he made to Abraham and to Isaac and to Jacob. And then God looked, because God sees. God knows everything that's going on. And then God acknowledged. God acknowledged them. He doesn't just see and do nothing. He responds. And he would send, at this point in the book, the deliverer, Moses, who is now 80 years old, back to deliver Israel out of Egypt. I want to leave us with these truths today, because God hears the cries of his people. He hears your prayers. He hears them, and he remembers. He remembers the promises that he's given to us, that he has begun a good work in our lives, and he is going to finish the work that he started. And God looks, and he sees everything that we're going through. He hears our cries. He sees what's going on in our lives, and God will act, but he will act in his time, and he will act in his way, and he will act for his glory and for the good of his people. Do you believe that?
Amen.
It's true. It's true. Well, let's stop there, and we'll take it up, not next week, but the following week. We'll take it up with God speaking to Moses from the burning bush and bringing him into Egypt to deliver his people.